This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is Sandra Cross, occasionally known as DJ Hybridist. Good afternoon, Sandra.
Hello, William. Thanks for inviting me.
That's okay. This is your voice that we can hear on this recording.
That's right, yeah.
Perhaps it might be worth mentioning that some people will be familiar with you and your voice, with your presence, at least, by the Ems Bar recordings.
Yes.
Which were also recorded from this train journey that
yes.
we're listening to.
That's right, yes. London to Leicester, Leicester to London.
So
yes.
that's what we're hearing at the moment. It's the London to Leicester train we can hear in the
yes,
background.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Which takes approximately, what, an hour and 10 minutes?
Yeah, slightly less than that, yeah.
Right, okay.
If they've got... Yeah.
And the Ems Bar recordings were recordings of buffet car announcements on that same journey.
That's right, yes.
Okay, and that eventually became, in fact, Johnny Trunk heard it on my programme.
Yep.
And was so taken with it that he approached you and it became a record.
That's right, yeah.
So he released a vinyl record called the Ems Bar recordings and also a CD on Trunk Records. And this has achieved some degree of notoriety.
That's right, yes. He, due to you and Johnny, something that I hadn't really... I'd recorded it for another project of mine called What Did You Eat Today? And I had no plans for it myself. I've probably said this to you before on previous occasions, so I hope this isn't repeating myself too much. But yes, it was recorded as part of this more extensive... project in which I attempt to look at the things that people are eating and look at the sort of not exactly the psychology of the choices, but try to figure out why people are doing what they're doing via food, how important is food and so on.
Yeah.
And the recordings, I'm sure we probably said this before, but it was for me the interest was not just in what the content of the recordings was, which was, you know, obviously a roll call of, you know, come this way, roll up, get your lemonade, or whatever it was, your cappuccino, your macchiato, and all the rest.
Yeah.
It for me it was more to do with the sound of the people's voices and the fact that they, although each person was reading from a script, they varied it slightly for whatever the reasons were, and so that was where my interest in it lie. Really, was the people were trying. Possibly not even trying, it was just happening within them to turn something mundane and commonplace into something that was more personal to them.
Yeah. So you recorded these, basically the buffet car announcements, on the train from London to Leicester and Leicester to London every time you went, over a period of how long?
Well, sort of off and on for about the period of a year. One of the things about that project was that there was no... There was a rhyme or reason to it, obviously. You know, the announcements had to occur at some point, but you could never guarantee when they would occur, and sometimes they wouldn't occur, or sometimes there'd be an apology about the fact it couldn't happen this day for whatever the reason was. So that might be why it was an extended thing. So it was also, I suppose it was, because this was at the point at which I started to make these journeys to my mother. So it may be I was looking for a diversion, or something that wasn't really... I was making the most of the journey. I was being opportunistic about the journey itself whilst furnishing this other project that I've alluded to. But yes, you may be hinting at the fact that the journey itself has become really quite central to my existence. And it's the journey, where it goes to, where it's the whole thing of where it goes to and where it delivers me back to.
So it should be said you come from Leicester.
Yeah.
Originally.
Yes.
But you've lived in London quite a long time.
Yeah.
But these journeys back to your mother, I mean, basically, the journeys became more frequent.
The journeys became more frequent, and for the first 6 months of entering into this new situation, which from my mother's point of view is beyond tragic, really. Neither of us knew where we were with it, really, and she especially didn't know where she was with it. So I visited her for about 6 months and I didn't write anything down. But after the 6 months, I started to feel that I needed to let this out in some safe space, as it were, because it was becoming challenging, to say the least, and I needed somewhere to put it, to put the experience of the day. So each time I saw her, and at first it could be twice a week, but ultimately became once a week for a period of 10 years. There was a timeline to this, so it was, you know, and the timeline wasn't only about the journeys themselves, it was also the number of phone calls that I'd be making because I needed to know how she was and so on. So each of the recordings has a timeline: 2 days later, one phone call later, five days later, six phone calls later, that kind of thing. So these, the timeline together with the journey, provided an impetus and an engine, literally an engine to the piece, because the piece itself is incredibly mundane, and that's how it needed to remain, because it is an example of how a life is lived in extreme circumstances, really, when almost nothing is happening except a lot of practical stuff still has to be done.
Why were you visiting her so frequently?
Because she was in such dire straits, really. My father had died. She had this diagnosis of probable Alzheimer's. And although she thought she could manage, and if there's only one of you, there's only me, I don't have any siblings, you somehow just respond without there even being a call. You just sort of naturally move towards something, and that's what I did. I found myself moving towards her. Because I don't want to make too much of it, but I suppose I could see that she needed it, and probably I needed it too. We all needed it.
But you had been, I think maybe for quite a long period of time, you were sort of, is it fair to say you were estranged from her or not? Or
we weren't close, but I came to realise that in fact that was nonsense too, really. The way that lives go, unfortunately, you only find out with hindsight that the things that you tell yourself aren't necessarily the way that they are. But that took a long period of unravelling.
Right.
And you don't get to the bottom of it anyway, because it's so deeply rooted in you. The way that you come to be in the company or environment of another individual, and obviously it works for them too, it's impossible to work it out.
So you started going up to Leicester on the train, sometimes twice a week, and you recorded the buffet car announcements. But then this in turn led to a kind of diary, or you were logging the journey in some other way? Or?
Well, I was logging the details of each of the occasions when I visited my mother. I needed, because sometimes, as I think I said, for want of a better word, and I don't really like to describe her in this way now, although I did then. She was temperamental, to say the least, and she was very challenging to be with and to be around. And so, as I say, I started to write a journal 6 months after my father died, and after I had first started to visit my mother on this extremely frequent basis, I started to make journal entries after each visit. So the visits could be every 2 days or 5 days, or ultimately it became every 7 days, but that was after quite a long period of time, say 2 years.
Right.
I got it down to 7 days.
Yeah.
Every 7 days.
And when would you write the journal?
I'd write it as quickly as I could, as close as I could to the experience itself, because one of the things that I was writing about was concerned about was my mother's loss of memory. And once you get a diagnosis such as she got, you don't know how long you have before the person becomes unable or incapable or whatever as it goes. My mother was very robust, shall we say, and for each person that gets that diagnosis, the outcome is entirely different. But when you have no direct experience of that, you only remember the stuff you've heard, and the stuff you hear is a horror show. Basically, you hear they get the diagnosis, and then all of a sudden the person can't remember you, doesn't know what your name is, that sort of thing.
Right.
I became anxious. As I said, she was an anxious person. I had become anxious in her company. We're both now anxious. One way of allaying the anxiety is to write it down, because you write it out of yourself.
Right.
And it was also to see what it looked like. What does this life look like now?
So did you have a purpose in mind when you started the journal?
Because I trained as a journalist, it was always a kind of a journalistic piece. I somehow thought that it would be useful, in single quotes, it could be useful for other people. I didn't want to write for myself. I'm not just writing for myself. I like it to be what I do, to be experienced by other people. I don't want to work in a vacuum. And because I had the direct experience of having been a journalist, I was writing it in what may be called a journalistic way, in an unembellished way.
Unembellished.
Right. As straightforwardly candid about her and about me. If I was candid about her, I had to be candid about me, my own motivations, as far as I know them, and so on. So, yes, I had thought that it might become some sort of more public piece of writing. But at about the same time, because it is one of those areas of illness that is developing without there being necessarily a cure, more and more people who were also journalists started to write about it. So it became not so much, it didn't have so much cachet, I suppose. It's a horrible word for the subject. So then it became more to do with me using aspects of the text in a sort of gallery sort of environment. Yeah. So I would use what I call outtakes from the text.
What do you think is perhaps the style, the way you write about such a thing? Did you start to question how you described it? I mean, did you find the journalistic method less satisfactory for some reason? Or
I think that now that I'm actually looking back on it, I think there is another way of doing it, which sort of mines the same material, but looks at it more from a, because I feel kinder both to her and myself, in a gentler way, in a less harsh way, because it's no longer about the act itself. It feels now as if it can turn into something else, but that's memory and hindsight.
Right.
So I didn't regret it at the time because I wanted to do it like that. I felt I needed.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get it down because I wanted it also to be, as I say, to be evidence of a life. This is what a life like this can look like.
Yeah.
In all its mundanity, and it was mundane.
Do you want to briefly maybe just sketch in a bit about your mother? I mean, where did she come from and...
Well, she came from a place called Oakham in Rutland, and she was one of four children. Her family moved to a new industrial town in the Midlands, East Midlands, called Corby, which only had one industry. It was called later became British Steel.
Stuart
and Lloyd's. That's right, and that was the only thing that was there. So she and my father, who she met there, decided to get away from the place as soon as they could, really.
You spent your early years in Corby,
I spent 9 years
didn't you?
There, yes, I did.
And what was your dad worked at the steelworks?
Everybody worked at the steelworks.
Right.
There wasn't any other thing to do.
Right.
So if you didn't want to carry on doing that, you had to do something about it.
Right. So then they moved to Leicester.
Yeah.
And, okay. So then, and then eventually they moved to Syston, which is a sort of a place outside of Leicester, maybe
6 miles out.
And strangely, as it happens, the clock that I always play at the beginning, at the beginning of my program, was a not exactly a grandfather clock, but it's one of those clocks with a pendulum which used to hang on the wall.
Yes, that's right. Well, my grandfather Cross, who also worked at the steelworks like everybody else, he won it he was an extremely good runner, and he came sixth in the field, a phenomenally large field of runners, when he was about 18, and was presented to Queen Mary or something.
Yeah.
And this was his prize.
Right.
So obviously,
Okay. And when you visited your mother, you would also photograph this bus shelter, I think. You took a series of photographs of a bus shelter.
Well, I suppose I was always trying to hold on to the moment because I didn't know how many more moments we'd got. So it no longer became satisfactory to just write about it. I then came to document aspects, you know, whether it was the back of my mother's head or the chair she was sitting in or the pet shop in the village or the bus stop. The bus shelter itself became a metaphor, shall we say, for the emptiness of it all, really, because the bus shelter was always empty and the plan was to photograph it each and every time I went there. But actually, that was a bit haphazard, and then very quickly they changed the bus shelter. They knocked it down, and for a while, I do have photographs of the empty space that it left, and then they put up a new bus shelter, which didn't...
It's a bit strange, isn't it? It's almost like trying to find something that is going to be constant.
Yes,
and
suppose
so.
Yes.
You kind of think, well, I'll document this thing because it's a constant.
Yes, it will always be there, even the bus.
But even that thing that you imagine was going to be constant, even that is removed.
That's right.
In a way that you couldn't have anticipated.
That's right. So I was looking for concrete objects that you wouldn't think would, you know, with my mother shifting, me not knowing, or anyone knowing, probably. What was happening inside her mind, even she wouldn't know that.
No.
Not completely.
Right.
And it was changing, presumably it was changing all the time, in, you know, at first in small ways and then in... It was all small shifts. So, yes, something like the bus shelter would have represented solidity until the next time.
Yeah.
You know, the station's still here, the bus shelter's still here, she's still in the house.
Right.
And this week... You know, maybe her memory's a bit better than it was last week.
Right.
You know, so yes, it's true. It's looking for some continuity, something that won't just disappear, which is presumably what I thought was happening to her. She was disappearing.
Yeah. Right, right. And I don't think when did she die?
She died last year.
Right. So what's this? Let's just play this a little bit more of this piece. That we can...
Scratching. 11, shopping. 12, pour soup into a pan, stick post-it notes on the pan. 13, reconstitute cocoa mix and fill container. 14, put ready-made sandwiches in fridge. 15, place all fridge items so that mum can easily see what each is clearly. 16, check sell-bys on foods and discard. 17, make note of all expenses.
So, what's the process that's going on here?
Once again, to keep in the spirit of the journal, which is, as I've said, very plain, very unembellished. It's just the matter-of-fact details of the life as experienced on that day when I am there, and as close to possible, as close as it is actually possible to tell what might be called the truth about what I've seen without objectifying it or being subjective about it, or I would be judgmental because that was the nature of our relationship in some ways. This, what we heard just there, is a list of all the things that I've done on that day. I can't remember how many points there are.
I heard number 16 there.
It might go up to... It's just a way of explaining to the listener or the reader, as I say, the very simple things in life that we all take for granted now have to be organised and orchestrated in some way, and all of the actions that need to go into that one action, like with the cocoa, for instance. I used to make it at my flat in London and take it with me because I was buying Green and Black's cocoa powder and putting honey in it and putting organic milk in it. And I knew that if I made it in her house... First of all, she wouldn't let me use the kitchen, so I had to always find ways around her. But I was used to that because that was, once again, the nature of our relationship. In order to be myself, I had to go around her, as it were, go behind her. It didn't turn me into a liar or a complete manipulator, but it did mean that I was familiar with her once again. I knew that there was no point in asking... for her to acquiesce, shall we say, or for her to negotiate, or for her to compromise. She didn't do any of those things. So in order to get something done that I felt she needed to have done, if I thought she needed soup for the next day, the only way for me to be sure that she was eating something healthy was for me to make it and take it and then put a sticker on it saying, Mum, here's some soup for you tomorrow.
Right. So how does that lead... The writing of the notes... possibly on the train or in Leicester. We've now got...
Well, I was writing, just to interrupt, I was writing all the time because I was afraid that my memory would fail me as well. So I'd sometimes be standing in front of my mother and I'd be jotting something down.
Oh, right.
And she'd say, oh, why are you always writing? And occasionally I'd say, right, I'm writing about you. Or very often I just tell a white lie. I just say, I'm just writing something I've got to remember, which was also true. But it was obscuring the fact that I was actually documenting her life. I could be standing right in front of her and she'd do something that, frankly, I thought would be good for the journal. So I wrote it down because I was afraid of losing it. Because it wasn't just my... It wasn't just me thinking I would lose my memory. It was just that the day was so packed. And these little actions were all that it came to in the end. It's just the little actions.
But also, I suppose, with her losing her memory, there was also a sense, I suppose, that she would never say that thing again.
There's that as well, yes.
Because,
that's right, yes.
Because the next time you saw her, she would, some other part of her memory would have, might have gone away, and you'd so there were these strange stock phrases that she had, weren't there?
There were stock phrases, but and those were things that I think just kept her going, and they weren't the same as repetitions. You know, like if she was very anxious and it was one of those days when whatever was happening in her mind was happening, she might say repeatedly, "There aren't many in here around here today," meaning, "Where are the neighbours? Am I really alone?" You know, like there's always a subtext, isn't there? So she would always have spoken like that, and she probably would have always have said that. But the thing here was that she had forgotten that she'd said it, so she might say it 10 times, depending on how anxious she was. But I came to realise that the way of, like getting her out of that was to keep her active. And my dream was just to get her on a fun fair every Saturday, because so long as there was life around her, people and movement and activity, she was okay. So that's what we did. We ultimately, we'd just be in the town all day, you know, going into this shop and that shop and being in the busiest place I could find.
I mean, can you, one incident I remember was with the keys that she had. Can you describe something about that key situation, which was a long, protracted, terribly time-consuming sort of series of incidents which became very wearing, and it's extraordinary how a thing like that could become so time-consuming.
Well, that's what I say about the list. You know, the list indicates just how these, all these things that we take for granted, we're just doing them without any single thought whatsoever. And the keys would also fall into that category. The keys are the keys to wherever you need to be next, aren't they? You know, your bike, your house, your workplace, whatever. But the keys, I can't remember quite how it started.
Well, she used to lose the keys, didn't she?
Yeah, but there's a, you know, she didn't just go from one position to another position. There were, you know, she had keys for the back of the house and she had keys for the front of the house. And because she was very sort of regimented, shall we say, in her thinking, you know, that would start with that. You know, you could never use the, and you could only ever go out of the back door or the front door. But these were not to do with what might be called her condition. This was her personality. So, you know, the, I mean, collapsing the time into the point at which the keys became an issue, in the sense of my mother would be putting the keys in a place where nobody else could find them. So she was either hiding them at night. So, you know, they could be under her pillow. They could be in the top drawer of the dressing table. They could be somewhere. That became like a game in itself, trying to find these keys. So in order to make sure that she always had keys, I always had keys, the home carers always had keys, anybody that came into her property, I had sets of keys. And, you know, as one bunch, if one bunch, if I couldn't find it, sometimes you couldn't find them and have to have new ones cut. So the visit to the key cutter was a fairly regular thing.
But the, at one point, I think there was a set of keys which were literally chained.
Well,
to
in the end,
inside.
Because it became just so ridiculous, you know, with so many phone calls from so many agencies saying, "Oh, Marjorie's lost her keys," or "Where are her keys?" and so on. I asked this friend and handyman who lived near my mother to, if he could erect some sort of apparatus just behind her front door, so that she could never take the keys off this chain, because it was such a heavy gauge chain that she wouldn't. At least she could open the door. She couldn't take the keys off the chain, so she could never leave the... But in that sense, She was never on her own anywhere. There was always somebody there. I'd organised it so she had days out and so on. She didn't go outside on her own. So I knew that she'd be safe to open the door and to lock the door at night. That was the main thing for her. Anyway, it seems that the first chain wasn't strong enough. It wasn't a heavy enough gauge, and she pulled it because she obviously wanted to go outside to see if the keys would work in the outside of the door. She yanked it off the wall.
Right.
So we had to get another one put there, and, and basically that's what happened. She never got... That was much later in the day, though. That a few years up the road, that was.
So describe what... Again, this text process that you've got at the moment, like this is...
I don't like that. She does. To brush off the incident, I asked her if she'd like a magazine.
How has the written journal developed into this spoken piece?
Whether she's forgotten what just happened or whether she's putting a brave face, I can't be completely sure.
Well, straightforwardly, it has... How it's developed is by me simply reading the journal in a variety of different locations. That they have to be the locations that are symbiotic, shall we say, with the original text. And I wanted to know what it was. I wanted to have a sound piece.
Right.
I wanted it to turn the journal into something else, and it is very different as a spoken piece to the way that it is as a written piece.
But the journal ended up with what? How many pages?
A journal's about 2,000 pages long.
Right. And these
recordings come to about 4 days worth of recordings.
So there's 4 days worth of...
It's a 10-year period of writing an entry at the very least once a week.
So we're hearing just 1 hour's worth
the tip of
basically,
the iceberg, yes.
Which is 4 days worth of you reading this journal that you made.
Yes.
She scoops out the fleshy part of the potato and mashes the outside of its shell. She mashes and pounds the tuna into mush as well.
And why do we hear the sound of a train in the background then? If you're
Well, one of the things was obviously I'm not a train. I realise now just how difficult it is to do spoken word, you know, in any sort of professional sense. And it had to be me that read it because it is a first person piece. I didn't feel it would have the same resonance unless it was me reading it. So I started out by doing a few test pieces in what I might call a dead or a blank space. You know, like the studio, not a studio, but a room where I was and the piece was and the recording apparatus was. And it had no life to it. Because the text itself is fairly lifeless, I wanted to reinvigorate it. So I wanted it to go on a journey again. So I took it back on the journey and I read it on the train or at the station, the train and the stations that I was using when I was first writing it.
Right. So this is at St. Pancras?
It's at St. Pancras station, on the station. So sometimes, much further on in the journal reading, you get the people playing the piano. You get what I like about it too is the fact that there's life coming in here once again. There are all sorts of elements of life. So you get people passing and just saying something, or you get another train announcement, you know, you get a Eurostar announcement, or you get the train to Leicester announcement. But it had to be the station, notwithstanding the fact that it's now Eurostar as well, the station that meant something to me. It's the station that I arrived at first when I first came to London. You know, I know it's a fantastic place now. It was always a fantastic place to me because I come into the city, the largest city in the land. So it brings me to the city and it takes me back there, and it's this constant coming and going. As I say, I wanted the life. I wanted to reinvigorate the text.
Combs out all the curls, pulls back the hair severely and secures with hair grips. First job back in situ is to work out how to use the key safe. For months practically since the home care started 6 months ago, social services have been keen for Em to have a key safe. I wasn't keen as I wasn't sure she needed one, and also it seems to give the SS a great deal of power. However, things came to a head in the week when, on an early morning call, 7 a.m, arranged so that the carer could check Em's okay, prompt medication and apply cream to skin condition, as well as a reminder that she's going out. This happens twice a week at the moment. The carer was unable to make Em hear the doorbell or the phone. Eventually at about 7:40, the SS phoned me to ask if the neighbour had a key and how we might solve the situation as they were concerned. Good neighbour was enlisted, and as she and I were talking on the phone, Em's bedroom curtains were drawn and the windows open. She'd simply overslept. Anyway, I consented to the idea of a key save after this fiasco, but think I'm going to regret it since I haven't yet found out about how home insurance is affected, etc. So with newly cut key, mobile and hand, the Out of Hours care team guide me through how to work the key safe. So now everyone in the neighbourhood knows that there is a key safe on the exterior of the house, and might as well have a neon sign on the door saying vulnerable older person within. Have to check a number of questions with the SS on this system. Good neighbour male pops over to have his instructions on how to use. Gave good neighbour female the code earlier. M says, why don't I know about how to use the key safe? She doesn't call it that or anything really. This is a bit of a gut reaction. I don't really think she wants to know. It's just that it's her house, etc. She has a point. Perhaps I'll try and instruct her how to use it on another occasion. Today time is tight. I suggest to her that she doesn't really need to know how to use it, since ordinarily she'll be inside and she has her own key. Good neighbour female pops over, chats about grandchildren and having been to McDonald's where they'd had vegetarian options, since even the 6-month-old baby is vegetarian. M pipes up and said she would have liked grandchildren, a subject like many others never discussed with me. But that since I was never married, I hadn't had any. This is completely made up and bypasses the fact that half the world's population probably aren't married and many of them have children. She did remember to tell good neighbour female that I was vegetarian, as is usual at the site of GNF. M goes into a performance act in which she's all exuberant animation. Good neighbour female uses keyword bike with this enacts movement on the tandem she and my father used to ride around on during their courting days. She sways from side to side and then collapses the bike onto the ground to indicate what happened on the day when she insisted on getting the driving seat. Apparently things got out of control.
It's quite like I like the sort of rapid kind of what do we call it? Elocution or something?
Oh, my vocalisation.
Yeah,
yes.
it's like you're trying to talk through it very quite quickly, but it becomes a little bit sort of Beckettian, doesn't it?
Oh,
it's
good, doesn't it?
It's a bit like a sort of
I'm glad
a
it
strange
does have
monologue where all the words kind of like. It becomes a stream of words, basically.
Well, partly, I think that was also what was missing when I tried to do the recordings by myself in what I call a blank space. My voice didn't have the momentum, which was why I wanted to be... When you're on a moving train as well, the train is giving you that energy. It's giving you that voice. Because it's going fast, you can go fast. And also, I like the idea that you're forcing yourself to read against the other sounds, what might laughingly be called the ambient sounds.
Yeah. It's suddenly given me an idea to thinking of the buffet car announcements. It would have been quite interesting to play this sound piece over the train, over the train tannoy, so that one heard it sort of coming out of the train. It would be yet another echo of the whole.
Oh, that would be brilliant.
But you'd have to approach. What is it? It's not called British Rail. What is it? East Midlands Trains or something.
Yeah, well, that
I doubt if they'd go for that, but yeah.
Yes.
In fact, I know Carpentry since he died before the RD was built. Before leaving, checked care notes to see what's been happening and also to check times care has worked, as I'm responsible for receiving attendance allowance payment and for paying...
So what's the next... what do you plan to do with it next, now that you've got this vast archive of...
Somehow the sort of written words... sometimes morphs into other productions, shall we say. So I have got something at the moment that is a visual moving piece, but I wouldn't call it a film. I'll have to find some other word for it because I'm not a filmmaker. But it's I have got a visual moving piece, which I would like to use in conjunction with the journal and to see how that goes, say, do an hour's worth and then see if there's any... if there might be any traction on it. It seems to work quite well with a visual component too. Well, obviously, because it's...
So the footage you have is of the train journey, isn't it?
There is the background to the train journey overlaid with other images, yeah.
Yeah. And then this voice.
So
It's like a sort of process. It seems to be going... I can't think of the word, but superimposed. You're sort of like laying layers of time over each other.
I would love to know what it means. I don't have the expertise or any kind of serious knowledge about psychology, but I would love to know what it is that I am doing means in that sense, because there is something that I'm digging at.
Right.
I don't know if it's... you know, lots of people do this when they've lost somebody. It's not right. What I'm doing isn't unusual in that sense. And also, I think, you know, biography, which is what this is in a way, is something that, you know, a lot of writing stems from that fact, because it seems that we don't ever really get to the bottom or the heart of something that has been in our lives. We've lived our lives.
Isn't it okay? You left Leicester quite a long time ago. Yes. You, as I said earlier, you were sort of kind of estranged from them. You might see them once a year or something.
Mm.
And so it's almost like there's this sense of regret, and you're trying to reconnect. Obviously it's too late, but it's strange in a way that you tried to connect with her once she was losing her memory.
Yes, well, that's very unfortunate, and it's not something to be in any sense proud of, because it means the other party is weakened. It's like being somebody's been felled and then suddenly you're there. But I have to say that, you know, given the circumstances, I don't think there was any other choice, and I don't actually think that I did it for that reason, but I can't be sure. None of us can be sure about why we do things. You can't be absolutely certain that you're doing things.
So I
would never have called it altruism. I never would have called it even kindness. It was something that just happened. It took place.
Well, it was necessary. Wasn't
it was necessary, yes. But, you know, as for...
But given that space of time, those 20 years or however long it was, when you didn't really see her so much, could you have done it in any other way? I mean, could you have related to her?
Well, this is the dynamic of the this is the dynamic of the family, though. Although there are only three of us, the dynamic is always such that you almost can't get in there, because the relationships between the two parents is one thing, and then there's how each parent regards the offspring.
Mm.
And then there are variations within that. So it's only when it was my father died that it was possible to see her almost. Because one fell away, because they became like one unit.
Right.
And I don't think that's unusual either. I think a lot of people say that about, you know, it's not just about loyalty or solidity or the long-term relationship or however you describe that. It's about, I mean, all of those things are obviously add. But it is about this whole nature of families in a way, isn't it? It's not.
What was her name?
Marjorie.
Right. And she had two sisters.
Yeah.
But they both went to live in America, didn't they?
They did, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, like as I said, because they all came from the steel town, which I think we have talked about it before, but, you know, anybody who wanted a better life left. If they could, they left.
So was she also had very little to do with her sisters, didn't she? In fact, strangely, it's just reminded me that when she did start to lose her memory, didn't she start to call you after one of her sisters? She used to use the name, she started to mix your name up.
Very occasionally, very, very, very occasionally, she might call me by her younger sister's name.
Right. Which was
but
what?
It was something, Jean. Uh-huh. But it was something that kind of popped in and popped out. It was like a, you know, it was like a plug coming out of the wall and then going back in again. It wasn't.
Yeah.
But because of the nature of our relationship, I wouldn't say to her, "I'm not Jean," or "Can't you remember what my name is?" There was no mileage in that with her, because she would just get angry.
Right.
So you had to find some other way in which you, and mostly that's by avoidance. And that's where the relationship ends, because if you're constantly having to avoid somebody because they cannot accept you and what you say, then there is nothing in the middle. And so that's why I think I didn't see them, because there was no space for me.
The size of small fields. Everything he did was exacting. I remember him as a distant presence, and his home as an icy space. Anne says that he did provide well for the family, and that they always had what she calls a good table, which she also believes stood them all in good stead, health-wise, until now. Manners were also something her and her brother and sisters had instilled in them, And something Emma's grateful for is it enables you to mix in all sorts of company. Em says her mother was nothing but a slave to him. With four children living in the country, she had to walk 2 miles to the nearest village and 2 miles back.
This is interesting. This is a section where you're describing her and how she related to her mother.
Yes, this is a description in the beginning. Well, this is this. These journal recordings are of the very beginning of me making these reports, as they were. So my mother would be thrown back into thinking about her mother, and so she would then tell me about her mother. But right. Once again, it wasn't a conversation, it was more a sort of venting of something that she'd been thinking. You know, I don't know that she wanted... I never quite understood what she wanted my response to be, so once again, that's why there was no response, because it didn't seem to be possible to get it right from her point of view. She would always be disappointed. So however you came at it, it, you know, and unfortunately, as you have alluded to, as her memory waned, she became softer and sweeter. And therefore, it was easier to get closer to her. But by then, of course, it couldn't mean the same thing.
Yeah. I do remember that I think the nurses at one point, didn't they refer to her anger? And or the carers, whoever.
Right.
And they thought it was part of the Alzheimer's. And you had to say, no, actually, she was always like
yes,
that.
Yes, I mean, I didn't want to spoil my mother's relationships with other people. Because obviously we all have different kinds of relationships with different people. People see one another quite differently. But there were occasions when I had to say, and it was actually in my mother's defense, because they were assuming that she was going further down this road. So I was only saying it to illustrate the point, which was that she had always been angry and very easily antagonized. So if she was, to use their words, having a go at them, this wasn't new. This isn't the Alzheimer's. This is Marjorie.
Yeah.
She's not, because they talk about disinhibition with Alzheimer's. She wasn't becoming disinhibited because of her illness. She would always have said that or done that.
Which parent do you think you take after?
Well, like all people, I suppose I'm a mixture. So my job, as I see it, is to do the thinking and meals. It's impossible to be entirely honest, isn't it, about who you think you resemble? You have to save some part of yourself for yourself, otherwise it's impossible to live, isn't it? I certainly, you know, the life that I've had, like so many people, is entirely different to their lives. But it's because of them that I've had the life that I've had. They did make some, you know, they made it possible for me to have a life of freedom, in a way, whether wittingly or otherwise, which was not necessarily the life they had. I don't know. They certainly were both quite resistant and reluctant people. They weren't very good with authority. You know, obviously, because of the lives that they led, they had to go along with it to some extent. I mean, I've tried to avoid it.
Try to avoid what?
Authority. Because I'm not good with it either. Where that leaves me, I don't know. I mean, people tend to find people who make long-term relationships are often quite similar in a great many ways, aren't they? I mean, I think they were both quite similar in some ways and in other ways not at all, so that it could work. My father was, you know, quite a gentle person. It wasn't that he didn't get angry, but that wasn't his first port of call. With my mother, it was her first port of call in everything.
Yeah.
You know, that was where you went first. You got angry first. And then there's nowhere to go, is there? I mean, what are you angry about now, you know? And as I say, you didn't know, as you know, because children think everything is about them. So if the person's getting angry, you think you've done it. So in the end, what you do is you don't do anything. So you think they'll stop being angry, won't they? Because I'm not doing anything. I'm just cowering in the corner. I have, but I look at them again and say, isn't this X's daughter? No, I don't think so, says Em. It's his niece. We've had this conversation many times. Em and my father were invited to the wedding in Scotland, but my father didn't feel well enough to go.
Em now remembers this as her having been invited and not being able to go because she didn't feel well enough. She's forgotten this event took place when Dad was alive. They were both invited, and my cousin's daughter sent them both a set of photographs. Em also said she sent them some money instead of a present, whereas I know that it was my father who did this. It's the anniversary of Princess Di's death, and the Daily Express is once again full of stories about the subterfuge surrounding her demise. Every time I visit Em, they seem to have a similar story. The anniversary has them going for broke. Em says what a lot of wicked people there are in the world and seems to approve of the conspiracy theory idea. Have also to collect Em's reuptake pills. The hospital sent a prescription to me in London, which I then cash in at Em's local chemist or one in the city. Today, there's a 20-minute wait in the pharmacist, as the pharmacist is out to lunch. Not sure how much good the pills are doing. Perhaps they work very subtly and shave the edge off very complicated, exhausted feelings. I've emptied bottles and jars, filled up cake and biscuit tins. I've thrown away food items that have lost their charms. I've travelled a further 14 miles one way and 14 miles back across country to escort Em to hospital, where I've asked questions and ascertained the future of the treatment. I've chatted with good neighbour female, popped over to find out about Mum's hospital visit. I will be making phone calls for the surgery to arrange transport for next week, to cancel daycare on the day Em goes to hospital and to cancel day centre visit re the same. I will also alter an appointment for Em to see the consultant about her skin condition so that I can stay overnight and accompany her, as the appointment can only be early in the morning and we have always to allow 2 hours for the transport. I've made an essential list, not for the first time, of phone numbers and pinned it to the outside of Em's address book so she doesn't need to comb through the contents. When I get back home, I feel totally drained, don't sleep, toss and turn, and feel guilty about Em and the run-in. Now I'm worried about how she is feeling and whether she got back to the house okay and worked out where the keys were, etc. I'm sure she'll be okay, as good neighbour female and good neighbour male have key safe combination if all goes belly up. Away from Em, I feel like a lot of debris or bomb-like fallout material in the form of emotions have disrupted my equilibrium. This matter starts to slowly come down over about half a day until I've sorted out Em's affairs again and have settled within myself. I remembered how she's always been. Once my first boyfriend died in an accident described as misadventure, she was unable to attend the funeral because she thought she would get upset. She seems to say she loves people. What I feel is her spreading out her need for love, which is totally different. I'm not sure in what way or ways this love has been expressed beyond clean clothes, clean bedding and provision of food. Em apparently likes food but hates cooking or doing anything that makes a mess, basically. But everyone gets this, don't they? Prisoners get this. I did have some nice holidays as a child, but that was entirely down to my father, who was a mad holidayer. I know Em doesn't realise that all of my, and to a lesser extent my partner's, actions for the last 7 months have revolved around Em and at first Dad. I don't want, neither does he, praise or backslapping. The most I hope for is foolishly the thing I always hope for, that Em would be pleasant, less challenging, for no good reason, paranoid, aggressive, rude, impatient, angry. I long ago stopped wishing that she would look at me with something approaching interest, recognition, kindness, trust, love, respect. She looks at me with hostility and always has, as if I'm her enemy. I don't believe this is paranoia on my part. You'd somehow expect more for an only child, something two of my parents did and have often drawn attention to, the coldness. Most of us manage a wide variety of emotions with varying degrees of success. Em hasn't ever thought about managing herself better. I suppose she isn't introspective. Perhaps she doesn't see why she should monitor herself. Her shtick always works, but it doesn't really, because what she wants, really wants, is disguised. Her true feelings have never surfaced. There's been no discussion about why she's so discontented. She'd almost not know what I meant if I asked her why she had always been discontented. But it's there in the little bits of information she does give out. How cold her father was, which she mentions constantly. In the middle of the night my father died, it was as if she had been immediately returned to who she'd been before she'd even met my father. She instantly became a child, crying about what a cold man her father had been and how different my father. almost thinking of her husband as her father. Now she was washed back to the beginning, as if all those years in which Dad gave her a life and protected her from the reality of it all and her own self just vanished. Is it because she feels so empty, she can never get enough love? Now she seems to have shot into being much older than when Dad was alive, even although it's only 7 months since he died. Postscript. Unless you get just the right pitch in your voice, M lashes out and attacks.
The strange thing is that as I'm listening to this, I have to remind myself that it's you talking. It's quite strange that I keep using that word strange. I must stop using it. But that it's almost more like I'm listening to her in a peculiar way.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
It's like...
Oh, God, I've been haunted.
Yes, because you're talking about her.
Yes.
And you've been with her, so, you know, you come back, you write the journal, so it's like I'm sort of hearing her.
Well, there is... it's interesting you say that, because I've got this quote from an exhibition at the Wellcome Institute, which is called This Is a Voice. And one of the things that has stayed with me is this quote that started a part of the exhibition. And I don't fully understand it, but I'm drawn to it and hope one day to understand it. So here it goes. It says, psychoanalysts have argued that the interplay created between the mother's and the infant's voice is significant in the development of the ego. The maternal voice has been seen as an acoustic container that surrounds and treasures the child. Psychoanalyst Didier Anzier suggested that this envelope of sounds contains the emerging ego of the infant like a skin, becoming a replacement for the womb. This semiotic stage of development, as philosopher and psychoanalyst Julia Kristeva framed it, is an emotional field tied to the instincts that dwells in the fissures and prosody of the voice rather than in the denotative meanings of words.
Emma's in good spirits all day at the hospital as we wait for the transport to take us back, and walks to a rubbish bin to throw away her empty water cup. There she reads from a notice board, returns to where I'm sitting, and tells me about a fashion show that was being held and how she would have liked to have gone if she'd lived nearer. The show took place a couple of days previously.
Well, you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's programme, today's guest... still is Sandra Cross. This programme repeats on Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. Sandra has been playing a sound piece, a text, a series of texts, 4 days' worth of texts, which you've recorded.
Yes, we've played some fragments from a recording which is called Limbo, like the journal is called Limbo, this is called Limbo, you know, which is a place between two places, you aren't actually anywhere. So this represents just a small slice of 4 days' worth, of 10 years' worth of writing.
Yeah, and then you have... been in the studio to talk about this event. Well, thank you for coming in. And it's going to be you will make a 1 hour film of this.
That's my plan, is to do that next and to see how that goes and to see whether or not it can become an ongoing thing where I add to that. So I add more visuals and more.
Right, right.
Until the whole recording could be heard. But I don't know what sort of environment.
5 days later, one would be in September 2006. Preoccupations of the day split into categories of empty and full. Repeats of observations are a given. Even though M is in a good mood on this day, the empty section is much fuller. Empty. Look at that empty house. Blinds closed, could be to do with sunshine or inhabitants having gone away for a while. No other explanation sought. Look at that empty house. No blinds or curtains. New people might have just moved in and haven't had time to fit new window screening devices. Look at that empty house. Curtains closed, inhabitants having a sleep maybe, shielding themselves against sun, watching TV. Look at that empty house. Skip full of junk outside, between occupants. Look at that empty house. Blinds closed, car on the drive. Full. How would you like to have a figure like that? looks in direction of person in question, pulls face of horror.
The empty house, which is she referring to her house or just observing other houses?
These are observations of, if we were usually on the day that I visited, we'd go out for the day, and so we'd be walking around. This sounds as if, from memory, it was probably in her neighbourhood, so she might draw attention to a property that looked as if there wasn't anybody living there. But as I try to suggest, you know, it's simply because the curtains were drawn because it was a hot day or whatever it was. You know, look at that empty house. One couldn't imagine what that meant. You know, it wasn't that she'd seen a for sale sign or anything like that. These were expressions of her mind, of how she felt. Yeah. They were, I suppose that's what projection might be, you know, you project out onto something, onto a safe space, I suppose. An empty house, you know, this is how you feel, empty.
I'm not bothered about cleaning anymore. This is after a lifetime of dedication to cleaning exclusively as a hobby, necessity, etc. To me, it seemed to occupy Emma unduly, morning, noon and night. If things weren't right, she would become angry. Now she continues, I don't have the energy anyway. Mantra, when talking about Dad, always slips into, he was a wonderful husband and father. We had a wonderful life together. Travelled the world a bit, had a beautiful daughter. I've had a good life. Giving thanks. Since starting this diary, Em's memory seems to be much the same, sometimes better, sometimes worse. And from this point, unless otherwise, Em's mood seems to be less distressed and angry, and our visits together more pleasurable. Other favourite memories include Granny Cross, having to wear a steel corset.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.